Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking now about science, science research, and education with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. We're really pleased to have him back to talk about science again, and I hope you'll join in with your science questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you email us at talk@wpr.org. Bassam, good to have you back.
Happy to be here, Larry.
Well, this Sunday, not only is it Father's Day, but it is also the official start of summer, if I'm not mistaken, in the Northern Hemisphere. To be science literate, should people know and understand why these seasonal changes occur?
Of course they should. But first, let me say happy Father's Day to all the fathers and the grandfathers in the audience. Yes, indeed. Learning about different events that happen in our society and different natural events is, I think, part of being science literate. And I'm very fond of asking people, why do we have four seasons? Of course, people recognize that we have four seasons. And what is the summer solstice all about? On Sunday, we will have the longest daylight time in the Northern Hemisphere. And I'm really curious if people in the listening audience would want to call in and try to tell us why there are four seasons. I'd like to gauge the level of science literacy in our listening audience. Is that a fair thing to do?
Well, we can, but I don't want to scare people away.
No, of course we're going to discuss this and explain, but it would be interesting to see, what people might say.
You know, the biggest fireworks show in the upper Midwest is scheduled to blast off on Saturday night, June 27th at Warner Park in Madison. It's Rhythm and Booms. About 300,000 people are going to be there. And you know, the fireworks are absolutely fantastic, and the colors and the noise and everything. And, of course, chemical reactions have to occur to make these explosives work. What are those reactions taking place?
Indeed, very fabulous chemical reactions take place. These fireworks generate three very noticeable forms of energy. Of course, a tremendous release of sound energy. That's the boom that we hear. Mm-hmm. And then bright light. That depends on the type of chemicals that are in the fireworks. And then a lot of heat. Yeah. We don't feel the heat because, fortunately, the fireworks explode up in the sky. The colors are produced by heating metal salts, such as calcium chloride or sodium nitrate. And each one of these elements, when it is heated, it emits a characteristic color. Mm-hmm. And what attracts our attention to fireworks is, of course, the sound and the beautiful colors.
Yes.
And preparing fireworks is really an art as well as a science. And now with computer technology, the shows are very, very, very fantastic. And just to say a few things about the colors. So a substance that has in it the element lithium in the form of lithium carbonate or lithium chloride produces the red color. So for people in the audience who are going to be enjoying the fireworks a week from this Saturday and throughout the year, whenever there are fireworks, when you see red, you can say that's produced by lithium. When you see orange, that's produced by the metal ion calcium.
Calcium.
If you see yellow, that's produced by table salt. You know table salt.
Sure.
That's sodium chloride.
Mm-hmm.
Sodium chloride emits yellow color when it is heated at a high temperature. This is what happens in the fireworks reaction. Green. How about green? Green is produced by barium, the element barium. Barium chloride is the form that the substance is in. Blue. We like the blue. That's copper salts. Copper salts produce blue. And a lot of people like purple. Do you like purple?
Oh, yeah. I like purple.
Purple is produced by a mixture of strontium or lithium that produces red and copper, which is the blue.
Yeah.
And sometimes we see a bright silvery color. That color is from the burning of aluminum or titanium or magnesium. So different chemicals produce different colors. And I want to emphasize in this connection two things, Larry, if I may. One is that safety is paramount.
Yeah.
The fireworks should be set off by professionals, and the rest of us should be sitting back at a safe distance to enjoy the beauty of the colors and the marvelous displays, the stars and the fallout that happens. And the second thing I'd like to say is that the fireworks around the 4th of July are really a celebration of our independence. It is Independence Day.
Mm-hmm.
We call it the 4th of July, and that's okay. But it's really marking our independence. And I invite people in the listening audience to remind themselves and remind others as to what Independence Day is really about, and to go back and read the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
That's easily accessible on the web and elsewhere.
It's a good thing to do.
Thank you.
Tony and Juno, we turn to you now. Tony, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi there, Larry and Sam.
Hi.
Hey, first of all, I'll give you an answer on your question that you posed.
Okay.
On why we're at a certain, or I believe you said why seasons change.
Yeah.
Well, my answer, there's a short answer, and that's because there's a change in temperature. The longer answer is why we have this temperature change, and that's because Earth is tipped on its axis. I think it's about 23.5 degrees, and as we orbit around the sun, we're constantly getting different amounts of sunlight hitting the Earth at different times of the year. So that's my answer.
Very good. Very good.
Very good.
Yeah. Let's talk about your first response, though. That has to do with why we have changes in the season. So, do you think that in the summertime, the Earth is closer to the sun or farther away from the sun?
I'm not really sure. I don't think that makes a difference, although I've heard many people say that that's the reason. No, I believe it's because of the amount of sunlight that is hitting us, not because of the distance we are, because that's negligible.
That's a very good response. I like that, especially when you said, I don't know. And it's really all right to say, I don't know. I don't know all the answers myself either. So in the summertime, actually, the Earth is a little bit farther away from the sun than it is in the wintertime, in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah.
In the southern hemisphere, it's the opposite. And so you're right. It is the tilt of the Earth as it moves around the sun. And in the summertime, the northern hemisphere is tilted differently than it is in the wintertime. And the same thing, of course, in the southern hemisphere. So why we have four seasons? This is the reason I ask this question is that there's a very famous study. It's about 20 years old now. It's repeated almost every year, asking Harvard University graduates at commencement, not only the graduating class but faculty, to explain why there are four seasons in the year. And 21 out of 23 respondents had it wrong. but our caller is on the right track, so that's
a good thing.
That's a good thing,
Tony.
Yeah,
you had a question?
Yes, I did. I also wanted to ask a question about the Obama administration versus the Bush administration. I wanted Sam to tell me if you think we are going in a better direction based on how science and technology is going than the Bush administration, and if so, how?
All right. Good question. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you. Yes, for sure there's a big difference in the public pronouncements that President Obama and his administration are making. And your question is it better? Well, you know, time will tell if it's better. I am very much overwhelmed by the freshness of what's being said. And the president can make pronouncements and can lead, but the real hard work in science and technology, the real hard work in any aspect of our society has to be done by us.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to answer your question, is it better? To me, that remains to be seen, because we have to do better. There are different approaches being now pronounced and pursued as far as climate change is concerned, as far as renewable energy is concerned, as far as education. It is really too early to tell which is better, but I would say the trajectory is really good, and it represents a different tone coming out of Washington. And I find that to be very, very encouraging.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned energy, and as a matter of fact, Wisconsin Public Radio will be at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association event. It's over the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We'll be there broadcasting. Veronica Rickert, Ben Marins, Gene Faraca, and myself will be broadcasting from there tomorrow. So it'll be a lot of fun, and I hope people, if you're in that Custer area, that Stevens Point area, I sure hope you'll stop by, because the Renewable Energy Association, it's the biggest one in, I think the biggest one in the world, and it's a lot of fun and very, very interesting what people are doing with that.
Your timing couldn't be better, Larry, because there's a report just came out of Washington saying that renewable energy could supply 10% of the U.S. power by the year 2020. That's just only, 11 yeah. years ago.
Yeah.
10% of all the U.S. power can be supplied by renewable energy. So different forms of renewable energy, and we need to look carefully at how this can happen and what forms of electricity generation can be used. Technology is really to serve us in society, and my fellow scientists and technologists are committed to do this. This report I'm talking about just came out on June 15th. It's published by the National Research Council in Washington, D.C., so that's I think if that happens, then what the first caller was asking about will show that things are better.
Let's go to Milton. And Tony, thank you again for calling. Milton and Cedarburg, we'll turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I always listen when Professor Shakashiri comes on. I think they're some of the best hours on public radio, and I would encourage everyone to go to his website and read his article on scientific literacy. I think it's very important, and I know he'll talk about it with you today, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
But the two things I called in to really say were about fireworks. I've worked in that trade for 25 years. And I would like to invite Professor Shakashiri to join the Pyrotechnics Guild International, whose international convention will be in Appleton next year. And there are all kinds of people who have an interest in fireworks, and they often don't get things quite right. For example, we never use lithium to make red. It's always strontium. Lithium is far too expensive, and we never use sodium nitrate, for example, because it's far too hygroscopic. But you did get barium right for green and copper for blue. But orange is carbon, usually a charcoal. And what I call my question was in the London Times, I saw on June 4th, 2009, a study from the University of Edinburgh. The researcher was Danielle Fanelli, and she found that 1 in 7 scientists say that colleagues fake data, and that 46% say they've observed fellow scientists engage in questionable practices, such as presenting data selectively or changing the conclusions of a study in response to pressure from a funding source. However, when scientists were asked about their own behavior, only 2% admitted having faked results. And so I think we need to be skeptical not only about things that non-scientists say, we need to be skeptical about things that scientists say, because just wearing a white coat and having charts and graphs isn't good enough anymore in the 21st century. And I really want to thank Professor Shakashiri for helping to raise the level of scientific literacy.
Thank you kindly for your remarks and for your observations. Boy, lots of things to comment about here. First of all, ethical behavior on the part of everyone, especially scientists, should be at the highest level. And yes, indeed, there are different reports and different studies that indicate the kinds of information that, you just shared with us. But it is unconscionable to have people fake data or misrepresent findings. You're right. We need to be skeptical. This is how we make advances in science, by being skeptical. Mm-hmm. Being skeptical about the interpretations of the findings, not about whether the findings are valid. I think findings have to be validated, have to be looked at carefully, and ethical behavior is extremely important in this regard. But the interpretations are subject to skepticism, different ways of looking at the data, and so on. So that's how we make progress in science. The pyrotechnics group that's meeting next year in Appleton. Sure, I'm happy to go there. You just send me an email message via the website, scifun.org, scifun.org. And as the schedule permits, I'd be happy to do it. And also, I invite you and others not only to visit my website, but to click on something called Chemical of the Week. And under Chemical of the Week, click on Fireworks, where we have about three or four different pages explaining the science of fireworks. Mm. And if I made a mistake in some information that I have posted there, I would like to hear about it. Mm-hmm. I am always wanting to have correct, valid information. So please, if you're still listening, go to my website and look at the science of fireworks. Speaking of that, Larry, on Saturday, June 27th, at the Memorial Union Terrace here in Madison, my group and I will be there from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. explaining the science of fireworks. We're not going to set off any fireworks. Mm-hmm. We are going to show the different types of chemicals that can be mixed that release tremendous amounts of energy. Among others, we're going to be doing a mixture of iron oxide and aluminum, the so-called thermite reaction. People in the listening audience might recognize the name thermite reaction. It releases a lot of energy in the form of heat and also in the form of light. In fact, the thermite reaction is how railroad tracks are welded. But we have other explanations, and we try to share for 1 hour prior to the Rhythm and Booms program that will come on then at, after
9
darkness.
O'clock or whatever.
Yeah. But we'll be there 6:30 to 7:30, June 27th, Memorial Union Terrace. It's a free event open to the public. My group and I have done this now several times. We're always happy to see new people there, as well as old friends.
There you have it. Thank you very much, Milton, for your call. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest at AUW Madison, Professor of Chemistry. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking science, science research, and education with Bassam Shakashiri and Bill in Shacton, Gloria in Montford are online. But you can join us, too, with your question or comment at 1-800-642-1234 or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Bill next. Bill in Shiocton, thank you for calling.
Well, good morning. I too, love it when you have Professor Sam on. And I have a question that I've been mulling over for a long, long time in the field of evolution. And that's about butterflies.
Okay.
What selective or survival advantage do they get from being brightly colored?
That's a very good question. They are not the only forms of life that are brightly colored. And I don't know the exact answer to your question, but you've helped me focus on it. And I will not only look it up, but post it, along with the summary I normally do after this program to on my website, to references that explain that. You're right. Butterflies are fascinating, and their colors, they have a purpose or different purposes. And unlike other forms of life. Chameleons, for example, they don't change color. So color in nature is very, very significant. And I'm sorry, Bill, I don't have an exact answer for you now about the reasons why the butterflies have those beautiful colors, but I will look it up and make it available.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill. Let's go to Gloria in Montfort. Hi, Gloria.
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
I've listened to you several times, and I've always enjoyed listening to you on the public radio station. And I think I am a science teacher, and I think that there's a great need for science technology, especially in the rural area. I'm in the rural area. But I have a concern about just kind of a career thing for myself. I'm looking at working, getting into my PhD, and what would you suggest the best way to go, you know, about getting my PhD? I've reached the level in my age that that right now I can do that. I can take time out now. My family is raised. I can take time out now to go back to school and get my PhD, but I find it to be extremely difficult to get into a program.
What is your major that you're looking for?
Science, chemistry, environmental, and actually energy is a real concern that I have.
There are lots of programs that are available, and I think people should look into them very, very seriously at any age. You say you're ready now. I think what you should do is explore different, the offerings of different universities as far as the area that you're interested in. I think Larry's question is very, very important. So, yes, environmental issues are very important. There are many environmental programs throughout the state of Wisconsin offered by the UW system and also by other institutions of higher education. Chemistry programs, physics programs, engineering programs, these highly specialized research areas can use a lot of good people going into them. So I would invite you to visit the, if you have access to the web, do it on the website by visiting the websites of different departments and areas that you're interested in. That's the Department of Chemistry at UW-Madison, for example. Mm-hmm. Or UW-Milwaukee or Stevens Point, whichever one might be of interest to you, and try to find out what the necessary requirements are to enter a PhD research program.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, one needs a bachelor's degree in science. You need good scores on the graduate record exam. You need good recommendations from people who say that getting into a graduate program is would be a good thing for you to do. So I think there are lots of opportunities. The key, I think, is to decide which areas you want to pursue, which is what Larry asked you first.
Yeah. For example, there's an environmental studies program on the UW-Madison campus. I'm pretty sure UW-Green Bay has one too, and I hate to just mention those two because there are probably most of universities within the system that offer a PhD program probably have something like that.
There are ecology programs here and elsewhere, Stevens Point, lots of opportunities, and I would say that the difficult step is the first one is to decide what you want to pursue and then find out and keep asking until you get satisfactory answers, Gloria.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Let's go to Mike in Algoma next. Mike, hello to you.
Good morning. Red flag went up when I heard the previous speaker, caller, regarding a study, and I thought I understood him to say that the study reported that 1 in 7 it's the opinion of scientists that 1 in 7 other scientists cheat. I'd like to question that as anything other than factual. It's only opinions. So what it did to me is it painted scientists as being less than honest. And from that study, I don't think you can gather that. You can make that opinion.
Yeah, Mike, I would like to look at that study too to see and so I can react to it and on an informed basis. But based on what we heard on the air today, I quickly said, and I want to repeat it, that ethical behavior is unquestionably one of the most important things that scientists do. Everyone in society should do and should. And if it is questions, we have to look into it. I don't know that it is really one out of seven. Again, I need to look at the report itself and see what it says. There have been incidents in the past several years. They've been covered in the press mm-hmm. and elsewhere about fraud in science. I would say the and those have been handled very well, and there have been retractions by the authors, somewhere in the United States, somewhere overseas. But I would say the scientific community, through the peer review system, is really, really good at catching any such misbehavior. And I think it is part of our awesome responsibility, not only to each other as scientists and technologists, but our awesome responsibility to our fellow citizens, that if we catch something that's not right, if we find something that's not right, that we immediately look into it and find out what happened and disown it if it's improper. So you're right, Mike. We need to look at the paper itself and see what those studies are really telling us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Let's take some more calls. By the way, we have some open lines again, so we'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Les in Merrimack next. Les, hello.
Hi. I'd like to ask the professor a phenomenon that I observed. We'll go back to the summer solstice idea again.
Sure.
I was always under the impression that a northern window of a house would never have sunlight come in. But then I observed that close to this time of the year, in the morning the sun would be in the window, and in the evening it would be coming in the window again, on a northern exposure. Could you explain that mm-hmm. phenomenon?
I think what's happening is that your observations, I assume your observations are valid. I haven't
sure.
I haven't made them myself, but I think what's I think the rotation of the Earth along its axis then will produce the effect that you are describing. But you know, Les. One of Larry's guests, Jim Lattis, who is an mm-hmm. astronomer, I think he's a better person to answer that question.
Yeah, and Jim will be on again. I'm not sure exactly when, but he's coming back on again, I'm sure soon, and we'll have him back.
And I'm going to look into this, and whatever I come up with, I will post it in the summary of this program that I will put on my website in the next couple of days.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. All right. So go to www.scifun.org. Matter of fact, I have the website up right now, and there is a lot of information on that website, a lot of fun information, a lot of great, interesting information that you are going to enjoy taking a look at. So I hope you do that.
And we will respond to the question that you asked.
All right. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We'll be glad to get you on. Here we had a time, I guess we have like 7 in 10 American students graduating from high school in 4 years. President Obama is asking Americans to commit at least 1 year of education beyond high school. Do you think this is a realistic goal? And I'm wondering what parents and schools can do to make that a reality.
I think it's a highly desirable goal. I think we should try to make it happen. it will be realistic if we work on it. The graduation rates across the country in the past 10 years, for example, in the entire United States, 66% of the students, of all students, graduate in 4 years from high school. In Wisconsin, the number I gave you, 66%, that was in 10 years ago. Actually, it was in 1995, 1996, so maybe 13 years ago. In Wisconsin, the rate is 77%. That's what it was. Now, the most recent study, which was completed for the academic year 2005-2006, the national rate went up from 66% to 69%, and Wisconsin went up from 77% to 82%. We're among the highest in the states in terms of graduation rates. Now, in order to complete a year of college, you have to have graduated from high school. I think President Obama's call for having everyone try to complete 4 years of college is very, very important. And I think it is realistic. I think we have the facilities, we have the institutions of higher education. One could start, for example, at a two-year institution and transfer to a four-year institution or go directly to a four-year institution. I think society now is so well advanced and dependent on science and technology that we need people to go into areas in science and in engineering and in mathematics. And I think it can become a very realistic goal. But we have to make it. The president can't make it. The Congress can't make it. The president can issue this call, set a goal. The Congress can provide federal funds. States have to be involved in this very, very heavily. They then will provide opportunities, as we do in public institutions throughout Wisconsin and everywhere else around the country. So I think, yes, I support making that a realistic goal.
Mark in Baraboo, it's your turn now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I think I can explain the last caller who had a question about the sunrise and sunset showing in his northerly window of his house.
Okay.
The first thing I think that we could probably assume is that north wall is oriented just about straight east-west, which is kind of unusual. But, you know, in the summer solstice, basically what happens is the sun is arcing at the most northerly point through the northern hemisphere. So what appears to happen is on the eastern horizon in the morning, the sun rises at the farther, or appears to rise at a point the furthest north. And then in the evening when the sun sets, the sun appears to set at a point that appears to be at the furthest north point of the year. So just during sunrise and sunset, it could be far enough north that a little bit of light shines into his north window, and then in the evening when it sets, it could set far enough north that a little bit of light could shine in from the westerly horizon to his northerly window. That's, I believe, what he might be observing.
I think that's pretty close.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. And, you know, one of the things that, Larry, I must tell you, I enjoy about being on your program here is that it generates a lot of conversations and discussions, not only on the air but off the air later on when people send me questions via email and otherwise. So it's just wonderful that people who are listening are participating in our conversations here.
Mark, thank you. It sounds right on to me. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate that. Someone else has sent in an email and is wondering what you think about cold fusion and whether it is one answer or our answer to the energy crisis, cold fusion.
Cold fusion has been shown not to be a real thing. If it were to work, then it would be wonderful. But all attempts in the past 25 years that have been made to make the process happen have not been duplicated. This is not an issue of being unethical or being fraudulent. No. It's just an issue that the studies have not been able to be repeated outside of the laboratories that where people have done these studies. The one of the bigger ones was about 25 years ago at the University of Utah,
yeah.
And that was debunked. Mm-hmm. And more recently, in the past 2 or 3 years, there was a study out of I think it's Purdue University. Again, making claims that cold fusion has been successful. I don't think so. I think it is not real. But I'm open-minded about it. If someone is successful in doing it, that will be very helpful to us.
Yeah. Well, what really? Some people are probably saying to themselves, "Well, what do they mean by cold fusion?"
Cold fusion. You know, the sun, the energy that we get from the sun. Is the result of the fusion that is bringing together small atoms, the nuclei of small atoms. And when they are fused together, they give off a lot of energy. That's the solar energy that we get. Cold fusion is a process that has been tried in laboratories at room temperature. So hence the terminology cold fusion compared to the highly energetic processes that happen in the sun. So cold fusion is not real, and the reports are have not been duplicated.
And it's too bad.
Yeah.
It really is kind of too bad. Well, I want to remind everybody that you will be doing your little experiments on June 27th from 6 o'clock to 7.
6:30 to 7:30.
Sorry, 6:30 to 7:30 at about fireworks and the chemicals associated with fireworks in Madison at the Memorial Union Terrace. And I can hardly think of a nicer place to be on a warm day in June than on the Monona the Memorial Union Terrace, right?
That's a beautiful setting. There's a band coming in after us. There's one before us. It's a whole happening. It's a big community event, and we are very happy to be discussing and presenting small experiments on the science of fireworks. And to everyone, you know, happy Independence Day.
Thanks, Bassam. Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. He directs Wisconsin's Initiative for Science Literacy. Take a look at his website. It's scifun.org, and you're going to be amazed at what you see there. Thanks again to Bassam. Coming up, we are going to talk about children and children's weight gain, especially during the summer season. Children obesity rates are rising every year. Sue Nitzke, UW-Madison Extension Nutritional Scientist and Chair of the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest next, coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.